miss you. And for today's episode, I have James of Purple Monkey, who's going to cover Sheriff Truman with me. So I'll let him take over.
Hello, everyone. So I think I should start with saying that Harry is probably my favorite character in the show, because he is our guide to Twin Peaks, the town, by way of Cooper. I mean, he's in every single episode of season one and two, and more or less shares the screen in every scene he's in with Dale Cooper. So they're a good, like, immediately you get a buddy cop relationship. But I like that he has, just like us as an audience, he doesn't have any real idea about the town's underbelly until Cooper turns up. And obviously, like, it's, to me, it's a show, and to a lot of other people, it's a show about looks and knowing looks and body language and the whole town, just like Laura is full of secrets anyway. And he certainly takes like a fascination in Cooper's whimsy. Like he's I don't know how often Harry's worked with the FBI in the past, but to have all these different sort of, you've got some real characters in the FBI who turn up to Twin Peaks as the show goes on. And it only takes place over the course of a month, I think, the first two seasons.
Yeah, it's each episode per day.
Yeah, so I think he's confronted with a guy he immediately sort of doesn't get on with in the shape of Albert Rosenfield. And I want to talk about his hot-headedness anyway. You've got Dale Cooper, who's just fascinated by trees. Gordon Cole, who's like, I forget his actual title. Is it chief of a certain division?
I believe it's director, at least by season three, but I'm pretty sure he's director even in the original series.
Yeah, and he's like really loud. Like that, you've got some real characters that Harry has to deal with while a very serious investigation is going on into, well, at first off, the murder of Laura Palmer. Then you get into the One-Eyed Jack's drug bust situation. Then you've got the shooting of Leo. It all sort of unfolds in like over the course of a month. I think this is probably the most police work that him and his station have ever had to take on. He's certainly, I had a like list of like his traits and in the fact that I've mentioned that he's hot-headed. He's definitely a country boy. Probably rarely ever seeing the world beyond Twin Peaks, and he's inquisitive to be learned in the ways and traits of someone like Cooper. He keeps a very open mind, but to the point of frustration in season two when they find out it was Leland and put him in the cell. He says he's just, well, no, sorry, before that, sorry about that. It's before that with
Ben Horn, I believe.
Ben Horn, he says he's just about had enough of giants, dreams, Tibet. And he's going to book this guy. And you can almost see a sort of sincere sadness between both Cooper and him when he sort of brushes off everything he's learned from Cooper so far. And to be honest, without any of Cooper's intuition and dreams, they wouldn't have got as far as they have done at this point, you know, with the dream logic and so on. But yeah, I think he's perfectly happy to keep Twin Peaks away from the ways of the rest of the world. He's, like I say, he's like a country guy, like he's a bird watcher, he's a craftsman, he's a keen fisherman. And it's, you know, crafts, much like making the lure for Cooper and like giving him the Bookhouse Boys patch, like that's a craft that's passed down almost from Truman to Truman, as he says it comes from his father, much like the sheriff's badge. As far as I know, his family have been sheriffs for Twin Peaks forever. Yeah. Like as far as you know.
I think it was either in The Secret History or The Final Dossier, but it is actually, you know, I know it's relatively subjective, but it is said that his father founded the Bookhouse Boys as, like, assistance brigade during World War II, and right. It just kind of just carried over to being the Bookhouse Boys. No, actually, my big takeaway for Truman, and actually why I think Michael Ontkean was, like, the best part to play this role, is that he comes off as, like, a genuinely good, like, leader of the community, But he also has that, you know, he has that friendly face, but also if he has to lay down the law, there's sort of like a don't mess with this guy type of feeling. And you see it with obviously Albert when they kind of lose their lid on each other. But even stuff like when Bobby's kind of just being a bit rebellious, you know, in season two of the original series, where he just says Bobby button it. And you're thinking to yourself, like, yeah, it's in his best interest to not really push this further. Even Bobby, I think, kind of knows to like not really overstep those boundaries.
And he has that hot-headedness, I think, on the very surface. I mean, at any given time, I wouldn't want to cross him personally, but I think he's very defensive in the eyes of authority outside of the station. Like particularly when is it Roger Hardy from the FBI comes down and sort of takes away Cooper's badge. He doesn't want to cooperate with the Mountie that's there and Roger. He says like you have. He's quite knowledgeable in the law. I mean, he would have to be because he's the sheriff. But he says, "Oh, you'll need a warrant and a subpoena. So right now, you can forget any kind of cooperation." He's alarmed when Major Garland Briggs is taken away by the is it? Forget the colonel's name, the colonel and his officers come to take away Garland Briggs. He immediately jumps the gun, like to be like, this isn't happening in my station. These people are my friends. He's very loyal as a person. He takes a, I think he takes it upon himself. He feels like he's got a lot of weight on his shoulders to stop a darkness like taking over the town that he's lived in all of his life. I mean, he's not a very spiritual man. He strikes me as quite an agnostic, like he needs to see evidence of something having happened for him to believe it, much like when Mike, Philip Gerard becomes Mike and explains the machinations and workings of Bob, how they work together. When Cooper's dream quotes, like the giant's sayings, become a reality, and then seeing Leland become Bob, as it were, in the cell. And he even says to Catherine, I think, in like the very next episode, is it the two brothers, that he doesn't know what to believe anymore. And he has a hard time believing in what's just happened just after Leland has like been revealed to be Laura's killer. And he's, I think I had it, that he says that this this he has a hard time believing in the realms of the supernatural as it is, because he says that this is way off the map. I'm having a hard time believing. And Cooper rebukes and says, well, would you find it more comforting to know that a man would rape and kill his own daughter? And in that response, he displays a kind of fear that Bob could still be out there now. If like Bob is a very, is a spirit, then he's certainly alarmed by the fact that we didn't get him, as it were. That's, I think that's, but he looks to Hawk as like, I think, his spiritual guide in a way, because of the workings, like the darkness in the woods that's encroaching on the town. He even looks to Hawk when Cooper mentions the White Lodge, almost as like a, are we ready to tell this guy? Like, so Harry is a morally good man, but he also has secrets in the instance of his relationship with Josie, the bookhouse boys, and whatever conversations have happened prior to our visit to Twin Peaks or off screen with Hawk. Like there's definitely very spiritual conversations there, which is quite strange that he is so involved in that, being a defender against evil, that he doesn't quite believe that it actually exists on a spiritual, supernatural plane.
You know, actually, I remember episode three. They start telling Cooper about the Bookhouse Boys, and they talk about the unexplained evil in the woods. I actually remember the first time I watched that, I was actually convinced that Truman knew way more than he was leaning on. And I was so convinced that when I got to specifically part 17 of season three, that I was honestly convinced that Michael Ankeen would be like, I don't know, they'd go see Sheriff Truman at either his home or in a hospital. And not quite explain, like, you know, the evil of the woods, but just kind of allude to it even more so that that there was like something larger at work. Yeah, I don't know. It's just strange is that was a scene that I clung to, thinking like for like a long time that Truman knew. But yeah, the fact that you're bringing up how he has a more of an agnostic view, that he has more of a seeing as believing. No, that actually that rings way further true, I would say, in my opinion.
But True Man.
yep. Oh yeah, it's the Longley set that her and
the
Frank are
True
both
Man.
True Men.
True Men.
But the other one is that I was thinking about is that how he can be relatively oblivious that there's all this stuff like under his nose. Like the most obvious one, or at least the one that's more firmly established early on, is when Dale Cooper opens up the diary and Truman's first instinct is he's like you don't know Laura Palmer, and Dale Cooper's like, have you ever been surprised before? And it's just so funny where it's Cooper, for as oblivious as he can get later on in the show, he's like so on point. And then also kind of piggybacking off of Truman being a bit oblivious, where it's like everything about Josie has been like right under his nose the whole time. And to be fair, when by his own admission, the most beautiful woman in all of Washington State, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that you would easily sideline by that. So that one I can't fully fault him. But actually, on the top of Josie, I've seen people be on like a couple ends on this. How do you view their romance? Because one of my friends, she's watching right now, and she's talking about how they're just like the most boring romance, and she's not invested with it at all.
Well, the most boring romance besides Evelyn and James. I find Josie and Harry's relationship to be more of a lusting relationship than a loving one. And I think he says that he's been seeing her for 6 weeks, is it, at this point, when Cooper asks how long has he been in love with her? Which I love that Harry uses that against Cooper later on in season two about Annie, which is great. So that's sidetracking slightly, but that just cements their brotherly sort of relationship and friendship. But you know, Josie and Harry's relationship, it's one fraught with I find frustration on his part because he's not getting the whole deal. Like, you think you know someone when you totally don't. I mean, I don't know how much he knew that Josie may have shot Cooper because of the vicuna coat, the fur that was found in the hallway outside Cooper's door. There's a look on Harry's face that could suggest that he knows who has a vicuna coat. It could be Josie. So, but then he is, as you say, quite oblivious when he's confronted with the very obvious before his very eyes. Like, he sort of doesn't seem to realize that. I think Cooper is concerned that sorry, he rebukes Cooper's concerns, believing that his love for Josie is enough to believe her regarding the sawmill fire that's going to happen. Like, he believes her at face value when there's so much more going on in there. Like, when she comes back from an apparent shopping trip in Seattle, he kind of just accepts it, believes it, they have sex and move on, and there's no love there really, I think, until he announces it to her, and she it doesn't make her stay. So his love isn't enough to convince her to that she will be safe with him. I think it was a bit of a wasted episode as well. I think it's episode 17 of season two. Is it Wounds and Scars? I think that might be the title, where Harry is basically in his home drinking Jack Daniels at breakfast and trashes his place. And then that's enough, like, for him to get over Josie by episode 18, where he just has a bad hangover.
Actually, that's one of my least favorite parts of season two, is that it's around this point where the show's starting to get better, but it's like there's a couple actively bad scenes, and unfortunately, this is one of them. I kind of think Michael Ancine, he seems like the type of guy for when he believes in the project, he is on board, like at his A game, but you can tell when he really doesn't care in parts of season two. And there's a part when, like, you know, when he's like drunk and he like destroys everything, like in the Bookhouse Boys, and it's like this is not a good performance.
No.
This is, and I think it's sad because, like, my opinion is, even though I'll never really fully like warm up to season two, it usually gets a little bit better every time I rewatch it. Like, it softens the blow, but that scene will never get any better because I feel like that was supposed to be a big part for Truman to kind of share that vulnerability with Cooper, and could have been one of the best scenes. But the thing is that they were just stuck in the thick of just like bad plot threads that weren't quite going anywhere. And Michael Ancine just sadly just seemed like he just like wasn't invested in it.
I do like, and this is still building on the sort of subject of Cooper and Harry's relationship, because they're in all 22 episodes, or sorry, 30 episodes of seasons 1 and 2. They're in every single episode. Like, there are some characters who don't make it in every single, particularly Sarah Palmer. Like, we don't see her till really the end of season 2 after Leland's funeral. But I do like how Cooper treats Harry in that scene. He's quite cold. He reveals, like, they've acquired her Interpol report, that she had 2 prostitution convictions. Just like, just doesn't even, he's not empathetic with Harry. And that's kind of like an exposure therapy for Harry, to sort of be confronted with these truths that were there the whole time, that he never got. Like, if she loved him, if Josie loved Harry, then you'd think he would be in the know of all of her outlets. But then you could say the same for James and Laura, Bobby and Laura. Everyone's got a secret and so on. But he, I think Cooper dealt with it in a very sort of Cooperly fashion. And then immediately in the next episode, he's quite sort of jolly with him and gives him, like, what is probably the most disgusting hangover cure imaginable to get Harry over it. But I did like that, and I liked Harry's admittance that, I've never crossed an ocean, I've never been to China, but she came to me. And for what it's worth, like Michael Onkin, his delivery of lines, like, get him out of here to Hank in the office and put the gun down, do make me laugh, and I can't help but, like, have to stifle the laughter. But I do admire Michael Onkin's performance as Harry in that scene, when he's like, I don't know, he's like sat on a stack of chairs or something holding a gun. I did appreciate the way they dealt with it there, but it didn't feel like it should have taken place over a day, which is what every episode of Twin Peaks more or less does. It deals with a day, and then we swiftly move on, and we're now spelunking in a cave by the end of, I think, the next episode, or yeah, episode 19. So she's more or less a sort of forgotten memory at this point, forever doomed to be in a doorknob. So.
Actually, that does lead me into two scenes that I think are underrated for Truman. The first, I think, kind of more or less kind of ties up the plot thread for Josie. It was the part where, when he's kind of on the rebound and he's in the sheriff's station, he asked Dale Cooper's like, why would Thomas Eckhart want to kill me? And Dale Cooper says, sexual jealousy. And they're just literally, Michael Ancine says, yeah. Like, it just crossed his mind. It didn't cross his mind until that moment of, like, oh, wow, this is the most obvious thing ever, and I didn't even think about it until you brought it up. But the other scene, I mean, that scene actually does get a laugh out of me. But the other scene that I do think is very underrated is when he goes to see Catherine Martell. It's like right after that, and they're both talking about, like, who Josie is, who is the real her. And it was Catherine that says something effective, how, who she is in that moment is not like, it's she could be changing from moment to moment. And that you did see the real Josie in some capacity. And it's about how, they both still have this kind of, like, almost respect for her, even though they know who she truly is now. And yeah, I feel like that's a scene that can kind of permeate with other characters, like especially Leland, of the whole who you are in that moment. But I think that, as far as we're talking about with Josie and Truman in particular, I feel like that was, like, the right scene to give, like, a particular type of closure for him to move on from, reeling from Josie, and to jump into the Windham Earl case.
I think, as well, slightly backtracking slightly with, like, the way Josie saw Harry as well. I think she's been wronged by men in the past, like Thomas, with Eckhart, with her ex-husband, with Jonathan as well. He's like a handler of sorts. And then you've got the prostitution cases. As Albert was saying, that she's going to leave a string of, like, well, there's like a string of bullet-ridden bodies across America. Like, she's been wronged by men in the past. So I think she has a hard time trusting, as morally good as he is, trusting Harry. He wants her to stay, and she says, are you asking as a policeman? And he doesn't respond. So, and he can only tell her that he loves her. So I think there was, like, a they didn't know each other, I think. They only knew each other between the sheets. I think that's as far as their sort of relationship really went. Well, I think it was when confronted with actual danger, did he realize that he was in love with her, maybe.
My take on the relationship is that, I mean, put aside my one friend, I've heard a couple other people say that they don't exactly have chemistry. I feel like it's one of those relationships that's not supposed to, because, you know, for him, he's just transfixed on her just because Joan Chen is still probably the best looking woman in Twin Peaks, like, now. I mean, I know she, like, you know, 60s, but she is absolutely radiant to this day.
Yeah,
but,
totally.
So, I mean, you know, to be honest, if someone, like, who looked like Josie was, like, you know, just had this, like, what seemed like a fixation on me, there'd probably be a lot that I'd sideline. And then conversely with her is that, you know, she has this, like, survival type of mode on at all times. And, you know, having, like, the, have the sheriff, even if she has feelings for him, there's that sense of, like, she can kind of, like, I don't want to say use him, but I guess you could say that, like, play to her advantage that the sheriff of this small town go after her if, you know, if there's that romantic, or at least, like, an illusion of a romance with them.
I think it's, a sexual motivation that makes Harry try and keep her in the town. I think, and my memory might fail me here, but their last scene together is when she's, I know we've got her death scene, but prior to that, the scene of her in the maid's outfit in Catherine's, he's like, why are you back here? Like, she's like, oh, Catherine's got a hold on her. And the scene ends with them just like aggressively making out with each other. I'm like, okay, so that's where I purely feel that their relationship is of a sexual nature. I think his words fail him because he's so enamored by her. And because he is a little bit of a, I guess, like a little bit of a lughead, as Albert would call him. Like, he's a simple man, I think, is Harry. And his heart's truly in the right place. But I think, their relationship would never have become something more than that, I don't think. I think when danger is apparent and present, then it's kind of like a fight or flight sort of motivation. Like, what do I do to keep this person here? What's kept her here this whole time? Oh, well, it's sex, isn't it? So then that's not enough. Like, the love isn't enough, because it could be seen as kind of insincere. Like, it's like a last straw for him to keep Josie there. So I wouldn't say it was like the worst on-screen relationship. I mean, I have a hard time being focused on anything to do with the Packard sawmill and anything to do with the Packards, Martells and Horns. It feels very soap opera, those storylines, to me. But when it is regarding Harry, Josie and her struggles, I mean, she's slowly... Her sanity is totally unraveling by the end of I think it's episode 16, where she dies. Like, she's like caressing the gun. She speaks to Cooper. She's like at her wit's end. Catherine's abusive towards her, and I think Harry entrusts Cooper to go through with an first investigation. No, it's not his first investigation. As an investigation as a deputy to find out more about her and Jonathan, to which he does. Like, Cooper is very thorough. He's very efficient in what he does. He will take the task at hand and he'll follow it through, even if Harry doesn't want to hear it, like any of Cooper's findings. Cooper goes through with it. And unfortunately, in a way, I feel like Harry should have been the one to see her one last time. But it would have just ended up the same way as every other time we've seen them, which is just like clothes going on the floor, making out in front of Jonathan at the window, for example. But I do, and that's the scene I love as well, is where Harry is the one to hold her as she dies on the bed, while you've got Bob there as well. I think Bob is almost there feeding on the grief, the death, the suffering that's going on. On that bed there, like feeding on the Garmin Bosia, as it is, before she is ultimately absorbed into the woods, or the wood of the Great Northern. I feel like she could have had something in season 3, and there are those Richard Beamer photos of her. I think it's like a stunt double of her in the Black Lodge for the filming of episode 22. So there was definitely some kind of closure beyond what we saw of her there. But that's one of my favorite. Weirdly, that and the scene where Cooper calms him down through his grief of Josie is some of my favorite appearances of Harry.
This is actually wind down Josie before I move on to Truman. But to kind of piggyback off what you're saying about Josie in season three, I think it was in the Twin Peaks Unwrapped book where they had the open letter of Joan Chen to David Lynch. You know, there's something we can do with Josie for season three being stuck in the Great Northern. But I guess the other one, before we really shift back to Truman, is that Pete Martell does say, like, when he's in the Great Northern, he's like, "Josie, I see your face." At first I just thought, like, because they established that he's like, he has very strong feelings for her, at least. But I remember thinking that it was just kind of relating to that. But I was like, oh, you know, who's to say that she's stuck in the drawer pull? Maybe she's just stuck in the wood in the Great Northern. And that really is her face he's actually seeing.
Yeah, I think definitely with the supernatural element of the show anyway, I definitely think he was seeing her in the woods of the Great Northern. And I think, like, her Harry Truman and Annie's exclusion from season three was a real disheartener upon my viewing of the show. But yeah, I did read that letter. I know that Michael Onkin even got his original sheriff's jacket out of storage in preparation for season three, and then it just never came to fruition. He never was in the show. And it's interesting that Robert Foster is playing his brother, because Robert Foster was originally up for playing the part of Harry Truman. So it's a nice sort of rounded swan song for the character in a way, I think. Oh, but yeah. I like Pete's relationship or friendship with Harry in itself anyway. I'm pretty sure Pete is the only one other than Catherine and Benjamin Horne and Cooper, obviously, and maybe like Hawk, that know of Harry's relationship with Josie. Mm-hmm. So that when they spot a woodpecker outside, and Pete admits that he loved her, and he says, "No offense, I loved her." And like, Harry says, "I loved her too." So it's they're aware, like Pete's certainly aware of their relationship. And beyond that, yeah, it's another secret in Twin Peaks that only really comes out when Cooper arrives in the town. Like, a lot of secrets unravel, like as you said earlier about you didn't know Laura. It's like, well, we don't know anyone really. And that's a mm-hmm. good sort of statement to make on anyone in your day-to-day life, anyone you've known all your life. It's a good character study, like Twin Peaks as a whole. And I think, yeah, Harry's a very important character throughout those first two seasons. That to not have him in season three was certainly missed, that's for
absolutely
sure.
So actually, one of the things I was thinking of, because loyalty seems to be a big thing that when we talk about Sheriff Truman, is that I guess the first one is that in the case of Hank, where he talks about how Hank was, like, not only part of the Bookhouse Boys, but was, like, the best.
One of the best.
And it's, like, it's obviously, like, by that point, Hank is very transparently manipulative. But I do like how Michael Onkin, he always has this facial expression of, like, he still sees that, like, friend from high school. And he, like, you know, he's never quite come to terms with the idea that Hank has just, like, just become the con man that he is.
Yeah, he's basically become the very thing that they were fighting against, you know. Mm-hmm. So that must have been a huge letdown, because, yeah, they all went to high school together. I don't know. Speaking of the Bookhouse, I don't know whether it's a hidden in plain sight idea, but the Bookhouse is right next to the Roadhouse, and the Roadhouse is a lot of their sort of stakeouts. I don't know whether it's perfect or stupid enough for the stakeouts.
And this is probably just more so about the Roadhouse in general, but I always thought the idea that there's so much stuff hidden in plain sight, the Roadhouse, is like a pretty big theme. Like, for example, like the fact that Laura in Fire Walk Me would like cry in public and then also have a more than contentious reaction with a couple of questionable guys.
Yeah.
And this isn't like, you know, in the back of a truck, or it's like, you know, in the parking lot. This is like in front of everyone while Julie Cruise is performing.
Yeah.
And then also there's other stuff, like in the pilot where obviously Ed, he goes down when, I forget if it's Bobby or Mike, but one of them hits him, but he talks about how his drink was spiked and he thinks it was Jacques. And yeah. Then I guess to bring it back to Truman is that the night before, because I actually just watched The Missing Pieces before this, his scenes at least, where he talks about how they're going to stop watching Jacques that night in favor of seeing what Bernie's up to. And it so it just goes to show that there is a lot that's like explicitly they know, but also can't quite get a lead on either.
Sure.
I don't know. I mean, you could probably make the argument that there's a the plot demands it type of situation, but I do also think the whole idea that there's so much hidden in plain sight, and then people just kind of like one reason or another just either can't see it or just willing to look the other way. I think it is. It does tie in with how the Bookhouse Boys is right there, but it's also it just doesn't quite work out. Like there's some that like is losing in translation once you get to the Roadhouse.
Yeah, I think it's good to watch when you're aware of the Bookhouse Boys and that Harry and a few of the bikers in town are part of that, I guess that secret club. Watching episodes, well, not the pilot, but watching like you go episode one and two, like when they introduce the Bookhouse Boys, and you can go back and watch the pilot, and you could almost say that Harry, when working with Cooper, obviously we know that he's a bookhouse boy, that he knows that there's darkness in the woods, that he's almost playing dumb in a way to appease Cooper, or like to the effect of Cooper, if you know what I mean. So it's kind of like he definitely knows more than he lets on. And I think he's found his match with Cooper is that he's more obviously because he's an FBI agent, he's more well versed in different methods and so on. When he sees when he that we do the Tibetan method, if that's what we call the bucket and rock toss, and Harry's a little bit beside himself, like, you really saw this, we taught this in a dream, and he's like, yeah, and he just gives him a pat on the shoulder to get on with it. And it's he keeps that, he maintains that belief in this person, like in Cooper, right to the very end. There's another scene which is my favorite, where Harry is waiting at the entrance to the Black Lodge, and I think he's got his rifle and he's just sat there, and it's early morning, just waiting for his friend to, because their relationship goes beyond the working relationship. You know, Cooper comes to town and says, you work for me. Then it gets switched around when he has his badge taken away, and he's then deputized, and then he works for Harry. He's like, oh, you tell me to drink coffee, I'll drink coffee. So it's really sweet to see that their relationship is like, it's all about loyalty, it's all about believing in one another. And I love that scene, seeing Harry like sort of on his own waiting for Cooper, and Andy's like asking him, does he want breakfast, does he want coffee, and so on. He's just like, no, and he just wants his friend back at this point. So, and he definitely puts a lot of, wherever it's like reluctantly, because Cooper, no, deduces straight away that he's in love with Josie. Wherever it's a sort of reluctant trust, he n knows from that point he can definitely confide in Cooper a lot more about the goings-ons of the town, who people are. Like, I call it the C-3PO syndrome, when a character gives a lot of exposition quite unnaturally, and it's for the audience's favor. But every conversation where someone's purpose in the town or someone's connection with Laura in the town is explained, it's very naturalistic, and it's through natural dialogue and questioning by way of Cooper, like, who's the dame, who's the lady with the log, when we do the Tibetan method, going through the list, and we get as an audience a reminder of that connection to Laura. But it's for Cooper's benefit more than anything. Like, the dialogue he gets is more for his benefit, not just us as an audience. It's almost like a better way of, a more natural way of moving the story and the plot along. And I think it's kind of kind of tongue in cheek alluded to when Harry asks Lucy what's been going on, and she gives him a rundown of everything that's happened in her favorite soap opera, and he's like, no, what's been going on here? So it's that naturalistic dialogue which I prefer, and a lot of other people do in shows, compared to other shows that are out around that time, that give you expositionally every single detail of what someone's affair is like with such and such a person, and what connections they have, and it was just one question, you know. And the way they have their friendship on screen is quite a natural friendship, I believe. I think they're both written, you can't write one without the other, and I think their relationship is written. It's one of the best sort of on-screen buddy cop relationships I think I've ever seen.
people always talk about the parallels of Dale Cooper and David Lynch, but I actually also think that in some capacity, their friendship is almost like of Lynch and Frost, where Truman would be more of the Mark Frost end. Because, like with Dale Cooper, there's the obvious parallels. There's that instinct, the dreamlike aspect. But yeah, Mark Frost, he's very invested in mid-20th century politics. And Harry Truman, as the president we're talking about, he was a guy who was like a sense of honor, like the whole people who make money in the government are crooks type of person. And they're just like the way that, when I see what the way Mark Frost views the world, I see that more in Truman than Cooper in a lot of cases. I think that that's how they would write them, where it's these two guys who are just like totally different, but they also seem to be on the same page for the most part. And they do have like interactions where they're not always on the same page, but more often than not, like there's something about that friendship that just, I don't know, it just works. And it's like you said, it's like one of the best on-screen friendships that you can get in definitely a show like this, but probably any show.
And you wouldn't necessarily say that there would be people that would immediately get on. You can always, you never judge a book by its cover. But I think, yeah, it's quite a very, I think you're definitely right with that, that Lynch is definitely a more spiritual person, much like Cooper in a sense, and Mark Frost, because you would say that because he's the writer, like he is the dialogue and story, and like Lynch is the vision, as it were, compositing the whole thing. Quite a spiritual person with quite a logical person, and I think Truman's quite a logical person, needs to see to believe, whereas Cooper just believes because he saw it in a dream. He believes because he sees it, and Harry needs to see it to believe it, which is quite a fun melding together. It reminds me a little bit of Mulder and Scully from the X-Files. Like she's quite a logical person, whereas Mulder is quite sort of out there and likes the truth is out there and so on. It's quite a stark parallel, I think, in those senses of two friendships. They're another TV couple, as it were, that I believe is a real strong friendship. And I think like Twin Peaks obviously set that standard because it was on before X-Files. And I think seeing that, a lot of the sort of two-hander sort of friendships that you get on screen, I think are thanks to how Harry and Cooper are with each other on screen. Even when presented with some of the more daft storylines of season two, they handle their the material really, really well. I think I lose a bit of my attention with season two, so it was a real struggle to put together the notes for Harry's development in season two. But I think even from the get-go of season two, he's developed all the way through. I mean, he's kind of semi-sidelined because they're in full investigation mode. There is a lot happening in the town in light of Laura's death. Now you've got one-eyed Jax, you've got the cocaine coming into the town, you've got Leo being shot, you've got Windermere coming into town, the sawmill fire. There, I think this is probably the most amount of policing work that the town has ever done, which is probably why prior to this, Truman has a definite sense of patience, particularly with like Lucy and Andy. This is obviously a town that isn't getting shootouts every day, but the Laura Palmer's death definitely set off that domino effect to open up doors, windows, whatever, to how much of a darker underbelly this town has. I think even Jean Reno, when he's with Cooper, mentions that before you came to this town, we liked it this way, no one knew anything. And it still questions whether Cooper coming to town was ever a good thing anyway, because he has, to a certain degree, like white knight syndrome, like when he goes straight in to save Audrey, and questions that with Harry. And Harry says, "You're an overthinker, you're the best lawman I've ever worked with," and lets him ultimately get on with that. I've sort of lost my way with that a little
No,
bit
that's
there.
fine. No,
Sorry, yeah.
there's definitely a lot to go by with that. But I guess in the case of Truman though, I do think of like there's a line in the final dossier where Tammy, she talks about how she believes that Cooper's absence, like after, the Black Lodge, actually hurt more than Josie's death. And it makes you think, like, whether it's a hypothetical 1991 season three, or just going by what we know from like the season three we have now about like what Truman will have gone through in those waking days of of like the absence of two very important people in his life. And that's not even going into like how you'd have Richard Horne on the rise later on in his career, and how like with Ben Horne and his omission said that it started off as innocuous, then it got worse as it went on. And I guess this kind of leads into the sickness that Truman has. I don't know. I know that in the case of like why Truman, not even behind the scenes, just like what we know from like the mythos of like why he was like so bedridden. Did you have any particular takes on like his absence in season three and how that kind of molds that whole season at large?
I mean, I mourned that he wasn't there, but I took it as, upon watching season three, I feel like the return. I feel like with season one and two, we're on the eve, like a very dark eve before drugs, unemployment, murder, and prostitutions become so commonplace, like immediately on the surface as they are in the return. Like you can see that from the level of phone calls they get from the switchboard. Like the police station has grown. And it is their crime is at an all-time high. And I feel like ultimately, since Cooper's disappearance or Mr. C's disappearance from after season two, that Truman ultimately wasn't successful in his fight with the darkness that was sweeping Twin Peaks, because you know how he feels about what's happening to his town. It's very he makes that very clear during his Ed and Hawke's discussion of the Bookhouse Boys, that they are defenders of this town. Subsequently, it can be suggested that Mr. C more or less encouraged and fueled the darkness that's taking over the town over the next 25 years, not directly, but indirectly through like people like Red, through Richard Horne, through these designer drugs that are coming over the border, through the police corruption as well. Like Harry, I don't think would have stood for that, but we'll never know. I do think Robert is also a true Robert Foster, sorry, as Frank, is a very true man, as it were. But I don't think as he's not as it's almost like meeting Harry Truman again for the first time. Like he's not well versed in the spirituality or the darkness of the woods that have been going on forever. I think it's almost like retreading the same steps we had, but spread over 18 hours, as it were. Like there's he Frank has his own issues and problems going on with his wife, and their son die their
Yeah,
yeah their son
he ended
died
his life at some point, obviously before season three.
We've entered the town again in a time where that dark evening has taken over the town almost completely. You have a few sort of outlets of hope in the shape of like the Double R Diner, and with Catherine Coulson as the log lady. You have small hints of hope. Carl Rodd as well. There's all these little glimmers still around the town despite that darkness. And I'm wondering as well. This is like a bit of a theory, but whether it's completely spitballing, really, that Harry got sick because of his interaction with what would be Mr. C. That Tammy, I think, says in the return that the officers got put into hospital from their proximity to Mr. C, that he's quite a disgusting person. You could almost compare it to like Dr. Manhattan in The Watchmen giving his own wife cancer because of how much time they spent together. I'm not saying that little moment would have been enough to give Harry any kind of starting sickness, but I wouldn't put it past the sort of lodge spirit, sort of like mentality behind it all, like how they operate. I wouldn't put it past a spirits like bad spirits operation, because Mr. C is the very badness of Dale Cooper.
This is the part where I kind of question the subjectivity in the Final Dossier and the Secret History. But according to Tammy in the Final Dossier, she actually calls the hospital, and I put in quote confirms that he's dealing with cancer. And I kind of look at it as like, in the case of think of like his encounters with Richard Horne in particular, or that is like the child of Mr. C. And I think that he, like Richard Horne is effectively that remnant of Mr. C and the deeply rooted sickness that has led to what Twin Peaks is, what's become now. And in the case of like with Truman, if he keeps running into him, he'll have like, this thing that he's constantly has to deal with. And it's, like I was saying about like a misdiagnosis with cancer, if you will. Because in season three, you'll get Frank Truman, he'll call him. And I love the fact that Robert Forster, like you can tell on his facial expressions that we can't hear Harry, but you just get the sense that he's not doing well. And the thing, and the what really caught me is that Frank, he says, beat this thing. Like no one ever explicitly says cancer. So I do think there's something about like if Mr. C can hospitalize, like these like law enforcement just by like just the mere presence of like after regurgitating Garmin Bosia, then what's to say that Richard Horne doesn't have something brewing within him?
Yeah,
And
exactly.
yeah, so I do think that in short, it is really just a misdiagnosis, or they just don't know what to call it. And that's what's keeping Truman down because, it's like if Richard Horne has it and, there's all this proximity of crime on the rise, that who's to say that this isn't spreading to other people in some capacity?
Completely. I mean, you see an illness in the town sort of physically as well. The scene that comes to mind is when Bobby Briggs comes across the ranting woman in her car, and like her, I think it's her niece, like next to her, just like spewing up, and it's quite frightening. But yeah, there is a definite sickness in the town. There's a sickness in Harry, and I think that's taken 25 years to fester and changed that town. And I don't know whether it, I mean, you could say stemming from that domino effect of Laura Palmer's murder, that it's the same sort of effect that Harry's lost two vitally important people to his life. He's now sick, and he was kind of like a force for good, I feel, that was keeping the evil off the streets, as it were. And I think he was totally indoctrinated in the ways and the thinking of Cooper and the FBI to have at least carried on that fight well after Cooper slash Mr. C had disappeared from the town. I'd like to think he did, but there's no way of confirming that at all. I mean, like I say, I don't think the fight was very successful, as we see the police corruption, the drugs, the unemployment, and yeah, and just the state of the people in the roadhouse as well. Like we get a very like a lot of people don't like those scenes that are added into the return of these new faces, but there is a puzzle there in itself, and I think it's a massive a helpful insight into the lives of Twin Peaks. You know, it's meant to be a town of 52,000 people, so why wouldn't we see these people in their day-to-day lives? And you can see it not just from Richard Horne, but in the eyes of everyone else who live in this town, that there is a darkness that has swept the town. So yeah,
No,
I don't think Truman was successful in keeping that fight away. It's impossible, really. It's a fight that goes beyond the physical plane, really.
actually, that does make me think. The first is about the Roadhouse, then a contrast of Harry and Frank Truman is that back in 2020, I did a rewatch of season three as like an 18-hour movie. And the thing is that, obviously, if you do it week by week or little by little, you can kind of pick up on clues and kind of like carry it over the next part. But if you do watch as an 8-hour movie, there's just something about seeing all these things so close together that just like, not maybe you can't say you get it, but something just rings true. Like, for example, in the Roadhouse, there's scenes with I refer as the non-character of Billy, about how everyone seems to run a character named Billy, and there's just like you kind of get a sense of these vignettes of like who this guy was and how people kind of talked about him, and like how these characters are on their own even separate from Billy. And I've come to find that, like, you know, the Roadhouse, I mean, of course, there's stuff like Shadow and She's Gone Away that are, like, you know, obvious highlights. But, like, the interactions I actually feel are a lot more central to just, like, not just what the town is, but just, like, just the feeling, the theme of, like, season three in general.
They're just as important, I think, as the rest of the show with the characters you're already familiar with. I mean, the format of the show in 25 years has changed. They're like it's like TV movies, which is like a lot of high-end drama the way it's made now anyway. I mean, you look at the original seasons, it's definitely there's definitely a different color palette. There's definitely, obviously, the scale is different because of the TV sets of the time. It's definitely a soap opera-ish format as well. And it's definitely a lot lighter, I feel, in dealing with quite serious subject matter. I mean, in the same episode, you get James Hurley singing Just You with the girls is very immediately followed by seeing Bob terrifyingly crawling over the sofa. In the same episode as you get Ed and Norma finally getting together, you get I think it's is that the same episode as when Mr. C goes to the lodge to see Philip Jeffries. You get those reveals, and they no matter their formatting, they still deal with horror and quite comedic humor. But there's definitely a different lens on the return compared to the first and second season. Obviously, they're shot completely differently. I mean, it's of a different time. It's set in a new, like the return for me set a new standard of watching TV anyway. It's lauded as much as the first two seasons were, as far as I'm concerned, about setting the standard of TV viewing. But you can definitely see the growth of the town. You know, like you don't need to see all 25 years of Twin Peaks, like what's been happening there, but you know something's gone horribly wrong. And I think that's definitely from that very first instance where Harry names Laura Palmer on screen for us when he's with her body with Doc Hayward at the start. It's a total domino effect from that point. Even though she's not around, you are still reminded at the start of the episode of start of each episode of the return, you see her face sort of superimposed there as a reminder that it's still about her and it's all stemmed from her death
Actually,
completely.
speaking of the domino effect, I know I say this a lot more now than I initially did, but I really don't think that Michael Ancine and Warren Frost get enough credit to show how important Laura was in the beginning. Because, you know, you think of like how around that's the same year Law and Order came out, where it's like you see a dead body and everyone's like losing their lid. But there's just that, like, those few words and just that, like, internal and then external sign of just like, just, you know, what are we dealing with? I just the sense of nuance, I think there really is no words for it.
Their body language in that first scene where she's unwrapped tells you everything you need to know about how important this girl was to the community. That you see it in Harry's face when he's confronted with these hard truths, like the cocaine residue in the diary, copy of Fleshworld in her safety deposit box, $10,000. Like you really unravel with Truman. I feel that he thought he knew the town that he grew up in, like he grew up there. He thought he knew this town when clearly he doesn't. Like, and I think having someone backtracking to saying, like, yeah, Cooper is a very important outlet for him, well, definitely an important companion for him in learning more about this town. And I think, yeah, he definitely suffered a loss. I know that they shot an extended scene, didn't they? It's in the missing pieces of Harry in the Great Northern hotel room with Cooper and Doc Hayward as well. And it's only an addition of that he just really needs to brush his teeth, I think. But you can see, even if Michael Lonkin wasn't in the Fire Walk With Me whatsoever, he still portrays Harry with that concern for his friend all the way through. I don't know whether that scene was reshot. I don't know if you do you know if that scene was
I
reshot
think
at
that
all?
scene was reshot. There's it's very subtle. Like they got that room pretty much identical, but I think there's just like the most minute of things you can pick on. Yeah, it's I it's kind of hard to mention offhand, but I'm pretty sure that scene was indeed reshot.
Yeah, I think is it Vinny? I think of 12 Rainbow Trout. He'd know exactly what props were in there in that room at the time
Yeah,
to like
Irv.
confirm that.
Actually, even like Stephen Miller, like that's someone where actually when I went to go visit, basically the Great Northern from the pilot last year in Kiana Lodge, I was like, "Hey, do you still have that wooden bear statue?" Like just the one that Stephen Miller listed off of his site, and like, and they just kind of looked at me. I was like, "Yeah, maybe I shouldn't ask these questions."
I think I don't think that Harry needed to be in Firewalk with Me. Like, you do get that insight into his relationship with Josie from the missing pieces, the ineptness and his misunderstanding of Andy is apparent in that scene as well.
That actually, I actually when I saw Harry Goes earlier this year, I was talking about like the that scene from The Missing Pieces where there's that distinct silence, and I always took that as if like Andy, even though he can't really verbally say it, he understands that something horribly wrong is gonna happen now that they're shifting their focus from Jacques to Bernie the Mule, and there's just something where it lingers on, and you can tell Harry just wants to be like, hey, go off and do your thing. But it does have a Harry has like this reflective look in his face saying, like, is this the right thing? Like, he's kind of guessing, second guessing if this is what he should be doing.
And I was saying earlier as well, I think it's where I was saying that the amount of policing work is something that they've never dealt with before, and I think he likes having Andy and Lucy around. Like, him and you don't really see many of the other officers in the station other than like the odd state trooper and so on throughout, like the in the pilot. But you feel that Hawk and Harry are the most adept police officers in that station. You like I say, you only get Andy as another on-screen officer. You get the I guess the deputies of the bookhouse boys are there as well, but they've never been so swamped by, I think Harry even says that there's a lot going on that he doesn't have, I think doesn't have the time for this. I can't, oh, he's talk I think he's talking to Shelley potentially, that there is a lot going on at the moment. They kind of have their hands full. I feel like it's Shelley, I could be completely wrong, but they have he definitely has a lot more lone interactions with other characters of the show throughout season two. Like, he talks to Donna. Like, when I say that, when you see Harry a lot, it's almost always with Cooper beside him, other than when he's with Josie. But you see him talk to like Donna. We see him interact with a lot of other characters that you'd never think he'd have much of a relationship with. I wasn't really sure how much he knew Leland prior to the start of the show. He even calls him Lee in the hospital, like as a sort of like nickname. So you feel like there is a bit of friendliness there already. I mean, you only really know Leland as crying from the start of the show. You don't really get a full insight into his life much as everyone else, their lives before Laura was murdered, until it's becoming apparent, until though that dark underbelly does come out onto the surface. You find out, sort of sidetracking here, that Leland is quite a corrupt person when he's talking with how they're going to deal with the finances for the sawmill, like to the Cayman, to the Cayman Islands, like quite classically. So you don't really know much at all about anyone other than through the eyes of Harry as he's dealing with them at the start of the show itself, I find. And then it's only when, like I've said, like when Cooper comes to town, that's when it starts to unravel everyone's secrets, much to Harry's surprise, I think. Like I say, he thought he knew this town and the people in it, and he truly, truly doesn't.
Yeah, actually, that does make me think. This is like the contrast of Harry and Frank. Is that we mentioned early on is that Harry Truman, he's like a genuinely good guy, but he knows when to like really lay down the law. And then but then you have in his absence, and we don't I do they I don't think they do they say an exact time frame of when he has like quote unquote cancer or he has a sickness, because it seems like Frank has been there for at least a little bit. I think in the final dossier they said he was going to be there for a couple years, but again, you can't really give a firm yes or no from the Mark Frost books. But ultimately, is that what we see of Frank Truman in season three is that, Robert Forster has more of a tough as nails demeanor. Well, he softens up a little bit, like obviously with his wife, and he respects his coworkers, but you do get the sense that he has a more of a tough as nails, like, he's the guy for the job, that you need someone who can be tough to take care of what's out there with this unwieldy problem.
I think talking about like how they deal with their problems, as I was saying, like we should talk about like Harry's hot-headedness. I think Harry is the younger of the two. Is that right? He's
I
the
think
he's
that's
the
correct, yeah.
yeah he's the younger brother, and he's definitely a little bit more, like I say, he has a problem with authority that's outside of the station, be they FBI agents or military officers. He will give them a firm backhand, and like everyone remembers his approach with Albert in particular. I wanted to talk about Albert and his
Yes.
relationship, and he says, you're meant to be the best, and he's like, yeah, and he's like, good, because normally if a stranger walked into my police station talking that kind of insulting crap, he'd be looking for his front teeth 2 blocks away on Queer Street. And I always remember that line. I'm not sure if Queer Street's actually a place in Twin Peaks. I mean, it might be a dialogue of a time. It might be a like a derogatory insult. Because this is the same Sheriff Truman who, when Denise comes to the station and she asks what the food's like up at the Great Northern, Cooper says, "You'll be in for a surprise." And then Harry, under his breath, says, "So will they." So he has that sort of what we'd see as like a bit of an archaic attitude towards certain people. I think he's definitely a good sort of parallel with Albert. Albert's quite immediately, I wouldn't say he's a hot-headed character, but he's quite sarcastic on the surface, and that's not to everyone's liking. Like Gordon Cole has to apologize for him in season three. But like with Harry, surprisingly, he doesn't like clock Hank in the jaw after Hank mentions his affair with Josie and how that would go down. He sort of gives a sort of like he slaps his own hand as like Hawk takes him away. Like it's on the surface. He's fit to boil at any sort of time. And that anger definitely it turns up when he feeds it with alcohol upon like Josie's death. Like he angrily dismisses Cooper in that instance, but he does it in a way of frustration as well, like when he's had enough of the giants and that they need hard evidence to arrest Benjamin Horn. Oh no, no, sorry. He states that they have hard evidence to arrest Benjamin Horn, but they still need stronger evidence than dreams to arrest Leland. So he kind of lets his own friendship and loyalties down in those sort of heated moments, I find. But they're not, we all have friends with similar sort of traits and so on. You sort of just brush them off like, oh, they'll be fine tomorrow, or they'll just give them a moment to cool off and it'll be fine. Like it doesn't overly affect his relationship with Cooper and other people. He doesn't react aggressively with Albert when Ed's regaling the story of how Nadine got her injury, like for a hunting trip. And I know that moment of Albert laughing, saying sorry, was a blooper that they actually kept in the show. But you can sort of see that this is the start of their understanding of one another. Like they definitely didn't get on at first. And then Albert ultimately tells Harry that he loves him, in that really famous scene. And then when Albert goes away for a while and comes back with evidence of where Windermere has been sending parcels around the US, they greet each other with a huge friendly hug. And he says that Harry's looking good. They even laugh together. He doesn't, like, Albert doesn't dismiss his policing. Like, there's that line, like, look, he's trying to, th it's trying to think. Like, he doesn't dim dismiss Truman's policing work now when it comes to lining up the facts that Benjamin Horne could have made this phone call from his office on the night that he murdered Maddie. The time frames line up, and Albert has a newfound respect for Truman without, explicitly saying it. But it's quite, that's another dynamic. That's another friendship on screen that I think is perfect as well. You see two men that sort of bash heads and ultimately don't get on, and then their friendship forms and cools off by the end. And I think that's also a misstep in a way, like to not have Harry be there at the station at the end to see Albert, which would ultimately have been one last time, because Miguel Ferrer like shortly passed away after that. I think after the either the airing or the production, so after the airing of the show. So they ultimately never get to have that buddy moment as well. They're the sort of things that you miss from season three. But I think Robert Forster as Frank really makes up for that missing piece, as it were, of Harry not being present on our screen. I enjoyed the phone calls he has with Harry because, like you say, even though we can't hear him, they feel very real, and you can see it in Robert's face that Harry is dealing with something, even though we've not seen that character in 25 years. But yeah, like I that with Harry's hot-headedness, I think he certainly cools off throughout the show in itself, and is only ever on the surface with that hot-headedness when confronted, like I say, with people in positions of outside power coming into his domain. He's very defensive, he's very protective of everyone that is close in his life, like completely.
Actually, this does make me think, because actually I looked it up in the Secret History about the shelf of everyone's favorite books. Do you remember which one was Harry's on that shelf?
I do not, because
No.
unfortunately I didn't get a good look at the
Oh
secret
no.
history before I started this.
Oh no,
Yeah,
that's
tell
all
me.
right. No, because I checked it a few days before, just because whenever I do recordings, I'm like, oh well, this character had something in this book or that book. And the one that I thought was very fitting was that Harry's favorite book was To Kill a Mockingbird.
Okay.
And the whole thing is that, like, obviously with Atticus Finch, he's in this like insurmountable task of he has to defend this person regardless of it's like, how other people perceive it. And that's, I think that just completely, I mean, obviously Harry doesn't go through like any conflict similar to that, but it does feel like there's some fundamentally in line with who Harry is and how, why he does the Bookhouse Boys. 'Cause, like theoretically, if like the Bookhouse Boys was just like everyone knew about it, he would still like defend like, his actions and why he did what he thought was right to do.
Yeah, I think he shares a lot more with Harry S. Truman, former president, in terms of attitudes as well. I mean, just as much as Harry is quite a sort of confrontational person, he's also quite a well, he subdued Bobby Briggs at the funeral. He calmed Dwayne Milford down at the funeral. I think it's Dwayne or Doug.
Yeah, it was one of
He's
the
a he,
Milford brothers.
yeah. He can hold his own in that respect. Can like sort of break things up and sort of. So he's not one to go straight for his fists. I think that's the only time we've seen him get into a tussle like that was with Albert, I think. I don't think there's other than like on the defense, like when they're in One-Eyed Jack's. There's been no outburst from Harry. I mean, even yeah, I don't think there's been any other sort of like aggressive outburst from him towards another person in the show other than verbally. But yeah, he can, he's quite a skeptical man. He's quite a cynical man, if we're going to go through like any sort of negative traits that Harry has. But as much as he is that, he's a patient person. And yeah, but that hot-headedness is certainly sort of just on the surface. You just don't know when it's gonna, well, you just have to, it's like just prod him and then it will eventually come out. And Hank does a good job of that. Albert does a good job of that. Yeah, for
Yeah,
sure.
it's like you need to have that that sort of like, he'll give you a couple chances and he'll make you know that he has a couple chances, but if you don't, he's not gonna he'll really put you in your place if he has to.
Yeah, I think that's why he's probably my favorite character, is that he's a very human character. Like, he gives in to moments of aggression like that. We all do. We're all guilty of it in some shape or form. He's quite a protective person. He's quite a passionate person, but that's just the way of me saying he just likes to like fool around, like with Josie. And then I think with Lana as well, like he's one of the men in the room that's there when she kind of rocks up to the police station, like Andy, Doc Hayward, Hawk, and Dick, and are in the room with Dick Tremaine, are in the room with Lana when she's like regaling stories about clowns, just completely enamored. So he's definitely, yeah, it can definitely fall for a woman, definitely can be seduced very easily, I think. Totally.
Actually, when you said that he's a passionate person, this is a bit of a false equivalency, especially if you think that this part of the Access Guide does not pertain to it. But do you remember anything about the passion play from the Access Guide?
I do not. No.
It's on page 68, and it says, "It is Glastonbury Grove you're standing in, a part of the Ghostwood National Forest, and a backdrop for the Twin Peaks Pentennial Passion Play, every 5 years or so. Of an uncertain date and origin, the Passion Play continues to evolve and is a profoundly moving ceremony. While a precise day and time are never announced, if you're in town during the month of April and your eyes and ears open, you can hear the quiet exodus of the curious and converted out of Glastonbury Grove shortly after dark to gather around the 12 great firs. From the shadows, half a dozen Kasak figures emerging bearing sword, chrysanthemum, crucifix, and chalice. There appears to be the mysterious guardian at the gate. To this day, no one knows where the guardian comes from or why it appears. Mystery surrounds the sponsors of the event, but rumors suggest the ultra-secret Bookhouse Boys."
I was going to say, that as you were reading it, I remember reading about it, because yeah, it's sponsored by the Bookhouse Boys, and it's all about the vanquishing of evil. Chrysanthemums are a type of flower, just okay. To put that out as well. So that's quite a, it sounds like something kind of midsummery, you know, with all the motifs that are there, like the swords, flowers, crucifixes, chalices. Yeah, mm-hmm. That sounds very it's quite that's quite a supernatural. It almost reminds me of Bohemian Grove, like
ritualistic.
Very ritualistic. The thing is that that's it.
When Dale Cooper's introduced the Bookhouse Boys, he says a secret society, and not that it necessarily has to be fantastical, but just that we were coming off of an episode where Cooper had a dream. I was like, okay, this seems like it would be kind of a natural trajectory, and that's when I was like enamored that Truman just had to know more about the woods, which I was, I would say, effectively wrong about. But there's just some about the way he said that and the way that Cooper said a secret society that I honed in on when I read about the Passion Play.
Right.
And because I have this thing in my head of who the author would be for the Access Guide. And in my mind, I just think that's Lucy was like handed this job to make like a tour guide for Twin Peaks. Okay. And it just kind of seeped out just random stuff like, oh, I gotta get this on a deadline. We'll just throw this out there. And no one proofread it. Again, that's just the kind of the lens that I read through it. So, you know, people can take the Passion Play as they will, if it's really the Bookhouse Boys or, you know, what's really true about it. But I don't know. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I was like, well, you know, if there's talking about the Bookhouse Boys, naturally, you know, Truman, Hawk, and probably Ed would at least know about this.
I think I take the Access Guide. It's quite a fun precursor to the secret history and mm-hmm. the final dossier. And it's not even like the Access Guide isn't even written by Mark Frost at all. I think one of the lead writers on it was a guy called Greg Olmquist. And he wrote guidebooks, like serious yep. guidebooks for towns and places. So this was quite a fun thing. And I think Robert Engels and Harley Payton had some doings with writing it as well. I think they had some involvement.
I could be wrong, but I think there was and I'm just going by just what I kind of remember from conversations with Mark Frost, but I could have sworn that I think it was Mark Frost and Lynch were a little bit involved, Scott Frost a little more so, and then there's a last name Werman. Referencing, like you said, the guy who did actual guides. Mm-hmm. I did listen to the episode of Twin Peaks Unwrapped where they got the guy from Access Guide.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I imagine that obviously he was the one that was more so heavily at the helm, or he had like the final say of like how the fundamental structure would be. But I just thought the whole thing about the passion play is like, oh, well, this would kind of change how I'd look about like the Buckhouse Boys and how maybe the sheriff department at large as well.
Yeah, I think the fact that the Buckhouse Boys have been around for a lot longer, you're not really sort of, it's not ascertained as to how long they've been around. I think, yeah, the secret history, at least in the show it's not, but in the secret history you're saying it sort of goes back to World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it was formed by Sheriff Harry and Frank's father.
Yep.
Is that correct? Yeah,
that is correct. Yeah.
And did they have a different name? It was called like
I think they just refer to it as a citizens brigade. It wasn't citizens anything brigade. Particularly, you know, unique. I think it was just sort of like, hey, this is something that happened in World War II. Yeah. This comes back to the whole Mark Frost definitely is transfixed with a lot of mid-20th century politics.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just kind of going by looking at it through that lens in particular.
Like a sort of Men in Black organization going on, like a sort of semi-free. Well, they're more like Freemasons, aren't they? Than
That's what I got from it. Is yeah, that it's like definitely with Freemasonry right. Where we kind of know what it is, but no one's really allowed to talk about what it is.
Yeah, and I don't think there is an informed bunch. I mean, well, I don't know how much of the white and black lodges are sort of discussed amongst the Buckhouse Boys. I mean, Harry and Hawk are certainly aware of it before Cooper is even asked, have they heard of the White Lodge? Mm-hmm. So they're definitely aware of it. But this is what strikes me. It's sort of like I don't know if it's a total fault in the writing of Harry, where he's very skeptical, but knows about these otherworldly supernatural things. I'm not sure whether that's like a reluctant believer, like where he has a lot of trust in Hawk as a person to relay information when it's required. But as a person who believes in it, like I said before, like he's totally agnostic with his beliefs in it. And he's probably, because it's a group formed by his father, it's sort of been handed down to him and his brother, much like the sheriff's badge has. So I'd say he's definitely a man of tradition then. Mm-hmm. He's definitely a man of keeping the town, like he says, away from the wider world, because of that darkness that ultimately takes over and spreads through the return. So, yeah, I think he's moralistically good, even if he doesn't quite believe in what he's fighting himself. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah. I feel like this ties into, have you ever read, not even if you haven't read the script, but at least like an overview of the original season 2 finale? Because there was going to be another scene where, while Harry Truman's waiting in Glastonbury Grove, it was going to be like a female knight from like
yes.
the era of King Arthur. And I remember Mark Frost was talking about how in the event that they made a 1991 season 3, there'd be plot threads that they'd have to reintroduce in a certain way. And I do think that there is, that sense of honor, that sense of him being transfixed by a beautiful woman, that there's just like everything about that, maybe a little more so in what I see in Frost writing than Lynch's. But there is something about Truman that was going to lead to something, you know, far probably beyond anything that we've seen in anything from like the books or season 3. I don't know. It was just a very interesting plot thread that just completely fits in line with his character.
Yeah, the episode 22 shooting script was ultimately different from what we got on screen. Like, obviously, they got rid of that motif. I want to say that she had a flaming sword, potentially. And it's kind of like the motif of the Buckhouse is that sword in the trees. And it would have been lost on a lot of viewers, I think. But then the whole of episode 22 is a sort of dive into the unknown and the supernatural that I think the show has been building up for, that you don't necessarily need those motifs at all. I mean, I think Bob was going to be in, have Windermere strapped to a dentist chair at one point.
There's a lot in there.
So.
Yeah, I think Bob Engels, I don't know if he said this to kind of soften the blow, but he said that he kind of knew Lynch was just going to come in and just completely redo the whole script. And there's that part where I'm like, Yeah, if I just kind of know I'm on a deadline, someone's gonna change it. Maybe I'll just kind of like throw out like these plot threads of Bob dressed as a dentist. Which by the way, I'm really glad that was not the note it ended on. I think that had they gone with that shooting script, I don't think the show would be talked about the way it is today.
I think, yeah, it would have lost a lot of it was on its way out at that point anyway. So I think what we got was definitely a huge improvement on the shooting script. And it also left enough open to wonder what could happen next. There was no form of closure knowing that that show was coming off the air by the end. There's never really any closure of anything that David Lynch does anyway. I mean, season three's ending is just as powerful to me as the ending of season two, but I can't imagine having to wait 25 years to know that the story was going to continue or have some kind of a conclusion, because that's quite a horrifying end. And it is with Cooper, who's no longer Cooper, he's Mr. C now, in that hotel room with Doc Hayward and Harry. And I think that's quite a nice, even though it's quite a terrifying scene, ultimately, it's quite a nice feeling that Doc Hayward and Harry are the ones that are with Cooper at his bedside, even if it's not Hawk, as Cooper would have admired that Hawk would come after him. But at this point, he obviously doesn't know he's missing. He just knows that Cooper's in a hotel room. He doesn't know he's Mr. C at all. But I think it's a beautiful note to end the show on, despite the horror that it is Harry Truman and Doc Hayward with Cooper at his bedside.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
that's quite a
actually
nice touch.
I guess it kind of comes back. It's almost like a full circle where you talk about
Yes.
how Truman and Hayward were there to unravel Laura, then the domino effect, and it all just comes full circle through the lens of the original series, at least, of them being proximity with what would later be Mr. C.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Just having a look at my notes here, sorry, just to see if there's anything else that we can cover about him. Do you have anything else that you wanted to talk about?
I guess the last thing, and it's a pretty minor note, but I know that numerology is a little more so like some that Lynch hones in on, but in the access guide they did show like the football team, and Truman's number was number 10, and
Okay.
as Cooper has his note in part 17 talks about how it's the number of completion.
That's
And
cool.
I'm sure that that was not something that like they had in mind when they wrote it. But I just think it's kind of funny because there's like all these things in Twin Peaks that just feel like they retroactively fit in. Like stuff that wasn't intended at the time, but kind of has this new meaning later on.
Yeah, there's sort of little ties that are sort of all these threads sort of tie together in their own little ways. I mean, you could certainly take it as that. I mean, with Fire Walk With Me, they had to retroactively put the pieces together for well, there was a few elements missing from Laura's murder that they talk about in the show. I think the whole poker chip gets kind of lost in that scene. There, at least you do get Harry's deliberation about tracking Bernard and Bernard instead of Jacques Renault as well. You get like the Yeah, he's seeing Josie, but that, speaking of Josie as well, you never see this a scene of her and Laura together when in one of their English lessons, I don't think. That's not in the missing pieces.
No, it's in the secret diary, or at least
Yeah.
Laura talks about it. I don't think she
Okay.
really talks about like, I think she talks about like she's doing it and that she has done it a couple times, but I don't think it goes into, say explicit details it would have been in the movie.
Yeah, and like Twin Peaks doesn't do a lot of thread tying, to put it simply. It likes to keep a lot of loose ends going up into interpretation and open to like ambiguity of the viewer. It depends what your everyone sees the show in a completely different way, particularly this one. There's so many different ways you can decipher a character's motives without them explicitly being said. You don't need to have every loose end, but numbers are quite important throughout season three. Chess moves are massively important in season two. So I wouldn't say it's like a, I think it's a lot of things would be taken as a nod to instances, I think it's great that it's number 10 on Harry. I think that Yeah, was it 253, isn't it?
Yeah, that
Is
adds
that
up
the
to
initial
10.
number? Yeah, that's the initial number that's given. I think there's a lot of things sort of peppered throughout the secret diary, whether it's from things that were already being shot or from scripts that were available, how they tie those ends together or make you as a viewer deep diving into the media that was released around about Twin Peaks to sort of pick out these little moments to suggest that certain characters have more of an overarching importance in the show, not just on the screen, but in their lives before the show. Like, without the access guide, I wouldn't have known, or at least the access guide and the secret history, I wouldn't have known that Harry, Hank, and Hawk were all on the same football team, that they had their shelf of favorite books, and that I think even Cooper's got a favorite book on that shelf as well. I
I
think
believe that
Lucy.
one's the something about the assassination of JFK.
It's got that totally makes sense. Yeah, like his fascination with that is very apparent from episode one. Yeah, I think that the deep dive into the other material, like I say, like it wasn't my strongest point with the show. I love having more material. I mean, as with any fan of Twin Peaks, having more material to sort of look into and get more of an uncovering. It certainly beats watching some of season two, but weirdly, as I've grown to watch it time and time again, I'm just enjoying being in that town as much as everyone else is who watches that show and seeing these little nuances, these knowing looks that all the characters have with one another, and just having these seeing the days and the lives of these people, besides like the politics of the Packard sawmill, besides all the drugs that are coming into town by way of the Renault brothers. It's not just about the police investigations, it's about their day-to-day lives. And I think Harry is one of the more grounded of the characters in the show that gives you a whole insight into the townspeople that he knew before we get the insight of the townspeople as they are. I think he's a great introduction to that, and that's why I said at the start that he's your tour guide to this town. Like he's Cooper's tour guide, but he's our guide to this town. I think we follow him hugely when he gets like this sense of defeat when all this dark underbelly is brought to the surface by way of Laura Palmer's death. I think he's just as important, I find. As he's just as important as Dale Cooper, I think, in the show,
No,
for
I
sure.
absolutely agree. But no, I think that says everything on my end. Anything else before we wrap up?
I don't think there's anything I can do a I can tell people where they can find me. Yeah, I run twinpeakspost.com. I'm currently, strangely, I think it came to me in a dream that I had to draw the entirety of Twin Peaks in comic book form. So I illustrate as well as work in TV and film. But yeah, I've taken on the task of illustrating at this point the pilot of Twin Peaks. So that's why seeing body language and looks and expressions are really important to me anyway, because I think Harry's got a whole host of them. But yeah, you can subscribe to the website at twinpeakspost.com to get an update when a new page is out. It's updated weekly. And I'm also on Instagram at Purple Monkey Limited. And you can find me on Facebook, although that page isn't updated as much because I use like Instagram more than anything. But Purple Monkey Design is on Facebook as well.
Well, I think that wraps up our episode, but thanks for coming on. I think this is going to be a great one for once you get it out.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and I'd love to come back at some point. If you don't have anyone to talk about, James Hurley, I don't mind talking about him.
Oh
So,
no, that one I would be all on board for, but yeah, I'll save that for another time. But yeah, thank you again, James.
thank you very much, Colin. Thank you very much.
Together forever.